This is 1A. I'm Jen White. Being stuck inside during the pandemic means many of us are reaching for television remotes to pass the time. And in the hunt for what to watch, HBO's new series, I May Destroy You, is getting a lot of eyeballs. It's a show about consent and trauma and the unexpected moments of levity on the path to healing. The New York Times called it, quote, perfect TV for an anxious world. Earlier this month, we got to talk with the showrunner and star, Michaela Cole, from her home in London. Michaela, welcome to 1A.
Thank you very much. Sorry, I'm walking, so I'm just going to sit down so that you don't hear my footsteps interrupting the sound.
I was wondering, I was like, somebody have a flip-flops? What's going on?
My floor is... That's my bare feet on my rubber floor. Sorry, I'm sat now. Hilarious.
Okay. I don't think, you know what? We're just going to keep going because that's just funny and that's real radio. So here we go. Well, first off, I want to just, you know, say congratulations. The series has received just an avalanche of praise. How does it feel for you having this project out in the world?
Gosh, how does it feel? It's quite a... I don't think I have the word or the vocabulary to really even name the feeling. It's strange. It feels like at every phase there is like a showing to the world. So it begins with my first few drafts and then allowing my script editor and my co-execs to read, and that is like scary and overwhelming, and then the cast read, and that's scary and overwhelming, and then it goes out and everybody sees it, and it's kind of like a continuation but an amplified version of that feeling.
That makes a lot of sense. For people who haven't seen I May Destroy You, just give us a brief synopsis.
Gosh, I'll give it a go. I'm always very bad at doing this. It's a TV series. It's 12 episodes long. And it's initially inspired by my own life. I had the unfortunate circumstance of being drugged and assaulted. And so I guess I wanted to write the story because I think part of recovery is writing and sharing. But then from that, I found all these other stories. And so the series is exploring consent and the line between sexual exploitation and liberation in the modern day. It's also about friendship and about thinking and curiosity and how we identify and how well we know ourselves as human beings, I guess.
I want to play a clip from I May Destroy You. And this is a scene where your character Arabella is trying to piece together the events of the night before. So she and her best friend Terry, who's played by Werruche Opia, call another friend Simon, played by Amel Amin.
Hey, Si.
Yo, I'm at work right now, you know.
Sorry, just one thing. I just wanted to know, how did...
Last night end?
How did it end?
Yeah.
I went to D-Rose Hotel. I went back with him because, you know, it was his last night. So I went back and then I went to work.
Hey, Terry, what's good? Is everything all right?
Okay, cool. But how did we say goodbye? How did it end?
Well, you were pretty waved. You said you had to go to work, so I walked you back.
You were with me, yeah? You were there. You were there the whole night. You were with me tonight, yeah?
Of course, man. You're good, man. You're good.
I'm out here going nuts.
So we just needed to call for confirmation.
Simon, I'm so sorry. I haven't slept. Thank you, yeah? Hey, Si, listen, why is my head, like, bleeding? My phone smashed?
I think you fell.
Yeah, you fell. Where's the blood coming from? Where are you bleeding?
It's, like, my head and,
Is it bad?
No, it's, like, yeah, no.
Well, that's good, then.
That's all good. Bells.
Yeah.
Just get some sleep, yeah?
Oof. Bye.
Well, Arabella figures out she isn't fine, that, as you said, she was sexually assaulted that night and her friends weren't around to help her. And part of the power of this is the way you examine friendship and the assumptions we make about the relationships we have with our friends. Can you talk a little bit more about how you explore that in this?
Well... Yeah, I guess these friendships on one hand are quite superficial, and when things get really bad, it can reveal that sort of superficiality. But also underneath that is real friendship. And I think the trauma allows them to discover the depths of their friendship.
Well, we heard from a lot of people who've seen I May Destroy You. And here's what Becca from Charleston, South Carolina had to say.
I'm a fan of the show I May Destroy You on HBO. I like it because I feel like it's more of a real, up-to-date, modern idea of what friend groups are like. I like that it's a very diverse cast. I like the dry sense of humor that she puts into it, and I think it's very clever how she mixes comedic elements with some really, really serious things in life that we all have to deal with, especially as women.
So as Becca was saying there, there are these really funny moments too, especially in scenes with Arabella's best friend. You have Kwame and Terry, played by Papa Essiedu and Waruchi Opia. As you were writing, how were you trying to walk that line between the seriousness of what you were writing about, but also those moments of levity?
The whole thing seems to have always existed on that very line, and I always try to figure out why the tone is as it always was. And I think back to my own reality and being in the police investigation room with my friend who was just there for me and babysitting me. I was literally handed from friend to friend because, you know, people had things to do, but also they wanted to look after me. And as I sat in the investigation room and slowly began to realize that things were really quite bad in comparison to my life before that, I looked over to my friend and he was playing Pokemon Go on his phone. And that's just, that juxtaposition of, that just seemed to be the tone that shaped the series. And not very consciously, it just seemed to happen. I didn't really go out of my way to put it in there, it was just there.
Yeah, a lot of the levity comes from these moments when Arabella turns to social media, where she sort of tries to distract herself, or the people around her turn to those screens as a way to disengage from what's happening. How are you thinking about social media and how we use it as you were writing this?
Well, from my personal perspective, I had used social media quite a lot. I was very active and had a really wonderful, beautiful relationship with, you know, in the virtual world, with the people that would follow me and comment and like and share. And I think that anything that wonderful can have absolutely horrific consequences. And I think for me, it was shaping my mind, shaping my idea of myself, shaping how I chose to see the world. And I don't know whether social media is responsible for that or whether trauma just makes you see things in a very binary way, good, bad, victim, criminal, black, white. That's how I became, you know, quite uniform in my way of seeing a world that is not uniform. And I wonder whether it's something that many people can relate to. And leaving or taking a break was very helpful for me. I left as I was writing this show, and I think it how my brain sort of changed made me kind of view how that may have affected my process, not necessarily in a good or bad way, but it certainly does affect how we process anything.
We got a question from Nancy on Twitter who says, I read she wrote 191 drafts. I'd be interested to hear about her process of revising and how and when she knew she was done. 191 drafts, is that right?
Yes. Yes, but I think there's slight confusion here. 191 drafts all in all. So not of the series, but of every episode. So like, what is that, like an average of 11 drafts per episode? So it wasn't that
That
bad.
Still sounds like a lot, though.
Oh, really? When I did Chewing Gum, the first draft, it took me 41 drafts to get that right. So this was actually really good in comparison. I love the redrafting process. I love it so much that people have to literally tell me to stop. Like, it's enough, Michaela. You've you've done it, it's finished, let it go. Mm-hmm. I can keep going. And when I don't think I really know when it's done. Normally, we just have to shoot it. So you redraft until it's time to shoot. And then while you're shooting, we might lose a location, we may lose an actor, and so you have to amend the script in order to adjust to the latest limitation, which happens a lot.
When you see the final episode as it appears to us on the screen, even at that point, does it feel finished to you, or are you still looking for things that could be tweaked or changed?
Oh, no, no. When it's in the editing process, which we did during the lockdown, you scrutinize, and my editors are really brilliant, but you have a thing called you've locked the episode. And when it's locked, it is done. It's truly done. And you're finished, and you make peace with that. And I'm happy for, by then, that's 2.5 years, by the time it comes to locking, I'm very happy to lock and finish. Because you've done all the groundwork as well. That's why there's so much redrafting, because you don't want to get to the edit and realize that you've left something out or you've missed something. So I prefer to just keep going until I know that by the time I get to that edit, I have no regrets.
Well, you told Vulture last month that you turned down a $1 million Netflix deal while pitching I May Destroy You because the company refused to give you a percentage of the rights. Talk a little bit more about how you came to that decision and decided to walk away.
Yeah, you know, I was, I've obviously, because it's come up a lot now since then, I tried to figure out why I took a second look at that contract and became uncomfortable. And I honestly have to attribute it to Kate Ashby, who is a character that I was playing in the last TV show I'd done. Uh-huh. She was a legal investigator, and she was so curious. She was, you know, resilient, would press and press and press people and documents, you know, justifiably paranoid. And I think I had some residue of Kate in me, but I became just, I wondered, you know, how is this all working? And I began to Google, and I think eventually I came across this word, packaging fees, and Googled that and thought something isn't, it isn't, I don't think this is right. And I think even the internet was saying, oh, this is, you know, maybe not the best way to do these things. And so I thought, you know, considering the show is about exploitation and robbery of power and consent, I thought it doesn't feel right to me that I would direct, star in, write, create, and not be able to keep a portion of my rights. And by the simple fact that I was rejected, it made me think I can't do it. The fact that I asked for rights and I was denied rights, just as like an idea, didn't sit well with me.
And I want to make sure people know Kate Ashby is a character you play in Black Earth Rising, the series on Netflix. We got this question from Maiowa, who says, is vision something you're born with or something you craft? To turn down Netflix, to rewrite until it's right, to find the right people means to me an unwavering commitment to a vision you have for your art. How do you cultivate that?
Interesting. I think that we all have a vision, and you have to scrutinize your life and scrutinize your head until it becomes clearer. I think that's part of the redrafting process anyway. But also I'm very lucky, you know, I had a brilliant team who would always remind me that it was my vision, even at times where, you know, insecurity, you know, makes you a little bit unsure. My team would always remind me. So I've been quite lucky in that I've had people who encouraged me as they helped me create all my shows.
Well, in this current deal with HBO, you have complete creative control as a series showrunner, a director, star, and writer. What is that experience like for you creatively to have that much control over this project?
It feels very rewarding. It feels like, you know, I see these shows as my children. And if you compare it to being a mother or a father, you want to be the mother. You want to parent your child. And so the trust that people gave me to steer the ship, to be in control, was beautiful and very empowering, and obviously very, very hard. But, you know, parenting is hard, isn't it? And there's a reward at the end. So it's beautiful, it's exhausting, and it's tiring, and it's scary to have that much responsibility. But it's great.
Talk a little bit more about that fear piece of it.
Yeah, you know, there's fear because there's so many people counting on you, assuming that you understand what's going on. There's so many questions that come your way, and sometimes that can be scary. I think the level of power given to me to make this show was something that I had to adjust to, was something that HBO and BBC and various artists, my co-producers, would constantly remind me that I was trusted. I was trusted, and I am the first point of call. So there is fear, but I think only other people can reassure you to help you manage that fear.
Well, Arabella spends a lot of the season focusing on self-care and writing about what happened to her. To what extent does that mirror your own process of healing and coming to terms with different things that have happened in your life?
I definitely think part of the process of recovery and processing traumatic things is doing things like yoga, meditation, painting, etc., etc. But it doesn't equate to some sort of resolution, some sort of finale, some sort of I'm all better now. It's just things that we do to carry on and to help us focus and to help us breathe. And so I went through all of those things. But also, I think whilst I did those outward things, maybe there's an internal thing going on as well, and the journey never ends. So yeah, I think it's just part of, it was part of my process. It is part of my process because it goes on, doesn't it? It never stops.
We're talking with Michaela Cole, the showrunner and star of the HBO series I May Destroy You. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from our guest and from you in a moment. Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
I'm Guy Raz, and on NPR's How I Built This, how a simple splash of color accidentally launched Sandy Chilowich into a 40-year career as a designer, entrepreneur, and creator of the now famous Chilowich placemat. Subscribe or listen now.
Back now to our conversation with Michaela Cole, the showrunner and star of the HBO series I May Destroy You. One of the things the show wrestles with really successfully is victimhood, the way being a victim intersects with race and class and gender and sexual orientation. And one example we see is in a flashback episode where your character is in secondary school. She and her friends disprove a white student's account of being raped by a black student. Tell us a bit more about what you were trying to convey in the series and some of the complexities that come along with that.
Yeah, I was very interested in the context in which people sit when they do very questionable and deeply disturbing things. Theo, I was very interested in creating this character who lies about being stabbed. You know, she cuts herself and lies and says it was this guy who, you know, did do her dirty because she thought she loved him and she thought he loved her, but really he did just want to have sex with her and he wanted to get photos because with his boys, that's what they were doing. They were in a phase of their lives where they were doing something, I mean, really bad, which is exchanging pictures of girls that they were having sex with. So she tells this awful lie, this awful lie, and it is awful. But then I wondered, what does that look like if we understand that when she was very young, her mom made her lie about being sexually abused by her father? So she learned from the age of 7 to lie and say all sorts of horrible things happened to her. She's been damaged by the decisions that her mum took in order to get sole custody of her child. And when you place Theo's actions with, is it Ryan? Yes, Ryan or Marcus. I'm not sure, I can't remember. But when you place her actions within the context of her family life and her history, how do we feel now? And I think it's just, it's never for me to say something's okay and something's not. It's just an attempt for us to try to understand actions that we feel are despicable, to try and see more of the person's history, more of the context, to see how we sit with it, to see that it's a little bit harder to jump to a conclusion. It's harder. That's what I wanted to show. I was also interested in the tribalism. In Arabella and Terry are in a school that is very hard, you know, for them, in a place where you are judged because of your skin color. How does it affect how you see somebody else? How does it affect how you see somebody else under those circumstances and under those feelings?
Well, let's get to another voicemail. Here's what one of you had to say using our app, 1A Vox Pop.
I've enjoyed Michaela since chewing gum, so I wanted to support. One episode in, I was hooked and enthralled in her ability to make you forget she is acting scripted lines that she wrote. I was excited to know we would have another opportunity to witness her seamless ability to absorb you into her world, albeit honest, without bounds, and worldly cultural. She is someone I would love to meet, and I would love for her and Issa Rae to work together soon. I'm a Black African-American male from the southeastern portion of the United States, and I very much appreciate everything she has done to make this a success.
Thanks for leaving that message for us. You know, Michaela, when I think about your character in Chewing Gum, which is how I was introduced to your work, and that character for me resonated on such a deep level. As a Black girl who was raised as a minister's daughter, there were so many moments in that where I saw myself, and I called my younger sister and said, you have to watch this show. And when I think about that, and I think about I May Destroy You, one of the connections I see is the way you just fully immerse yourself in these characters. When does that immersion process start for you? Is it during the writing process, or once it's all on paper and in some form that you start to really figure out how to embody those characters?
Definitely during the writing process, I would say. I find writing very immersive. And as I write, in my mind, I have some notion of how I'll say the lines when we do our first take. Definitely, I think all the characters that I write, I somehow embody. But obviously couldn't play all of them because actors can do that much, much better than I can. From the very beginning.
So in 2018, you became the first Black woman to give the lecture at the Edinburgh International Television Festival. And this is a prestigious insiders event. It's been around for 40 years. And you discussed your sexual assault publicly for the first time. You also described the problematic dynamics on the set of your award-winning sitcom, Chewing Gum. What was that moment like for you, and how did people receive it?
Yeah, I think there was what I can only read as shock, embarrassment, and maybe anger at me knocking at the door, opening a door into the production office, which I'd never been in before. And with TV industry, it's almost as if it wasn't my place to knock on that door and say the things that I said. But after that, I don't remember much about how it was received. The only thing I really held on to was fixing it, was figuring out a way to fix everything. And we did. So, yeah.
I would imagine this isn't the first time you had these conversations, though, because among your fellow actors, you know, these same thing in my industry, we have these conversations that we have in private, but not necessarily in a public setting all of the time. What was the response from, you know, some of your other colleagues who are people of color?
I could see sadness. I think it was sad. It was sad to have the woman who plays my mom in that situation. And I think we were gutted because it was my show. And that is, it's a failure because I represent this project for them. It's me. And so that is it's a failure. So yeah, it's sad. It's sad. And, you know, you're never going to have a perfect show. But what's important to me is maybe how you're remembered. What kind of legacy do you want to leave? Which is what I said to the team, you know, the producers. How do you want to be remembered? How do you want to be spoken of when this is done? You know, we don't want people to have these stories, but now we do.
We'll have more right after a short break. This is 1A.
Fifty years ago, Chicanos marched through Los Angeles to protest the Vietnam War. They were met with overwhelming police force. It shaped a generation of Chicanos, leaving some inspired and others scarred.
I remember the word Chicano being a bad word.
The legacy of the Chicano moratorium. Listen now to the It's Been a Minute podcast from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Jen White. Let's return now to the conclusion of my conversation with Michaela Cole of HBO's I May Destroy You. When you think about people who are working with you on this project, I May Destroy You, what do you hope they say about Michaela Cole, the showrunner?
Oh, how interesting. Well, my producer, who I took out for a walk a couple of weeks ago to say thank you, said that I'm receptive to people's opinions and feelings. So I don't know what I hope, but that I value very much and I hold close to my heart. I'd like to think that I managed my ego as best as I could and try to leave it at the door before every interaction that I made. And I'd like to be remembered as being present with whoever I was interacting with, and willing and collaborative. Yeah. What helped shape how I behave as a showrunner is probably Hugo Blick, who was the showrunner of Black Earth Rising. He wrote it, exec produced it, directed it, and starred in it. And I shot that with him all in all for 9 months and trained, you know, I had to learn how to row and I had to learn how to try and speak in a different, more pronounced accent. So I was with him for a very long time. And he is the person that I really look to when I want to see how I want to behave as a showrunner. He was always very calm. He was never visibly stressed. He was very focused. He was never sleepy. He was always very present and always knew every detail of what we were doing on every single day. And I thought, I want to do it like that.
You've been very vocal on social media over the years about colorism in the industry and the ways people hide behind diversity initiatives. How do you reflect on your own experiences dealing with colorism, and where do you see the industry needing to change most?
You know, I think in many ways the industry is doing great. I'm here, Lupita's here, Cynthia Erivo's here, Lena Waithe's here. There are loads of, you know, Issa Rae's here. So that's beautiful. That is so beautiful. Not Molly, Yvonne.
Yeah, Yvonne Orji, yes.
Yeah, exactly. But there's still many ways, many areas in which it can probably improve. I also do think in my country, for sure, that there is perhaps a shortage of actors who are of dual heritage. I think that is a thing, you know, when I look at BBC dramas and ITV and Channel 4, all of the dramas, perhaps there is a little shortage there. So whilst I can say things need to improve for dark-skinned women, I think there is also a way to go with lighter-skinned women. I really do. And I feel like, you know, I have friends from a large diversity of backgrounds. And the more we talk, the more we realize we have in common. And the more we, you know, look at each other, we try to figure out, wait, where is the source of all this contention coming from? I think a lot of this is to do with bigger power structures at play. And I don't know how to fix these things. I'm sure somebody much smarter than me might have a bit more of a clue.
Well, in the wake of George Floyd's death, HBO asked you to release a statement and you decided to write a poem for Floyd and his mother. Tell us about the poem and how you processed his death at that time on a personal level, but also as someone who's very public facing.
Yeah. Yes. And I think it's really important to make a comment. So in no way is that a negative thing to be asked to speak instead of being silent, I think is a very good thing. But for me, and I'm sure for many, many people, there is this huge anxiety about speaking, about tweeting. I rarely tweet, so it seemed strange. But I wanted to do it because I wanted to honor the fact that this was happening. And so I meditated. It's what I do. I've meditated before. I'm very cool. And in the middle of the meditation, this vision came to me of America and the UK and us looking over, just weeping with our hands stretched. And this poem came to me. And I think it did help me at least not avoid the sorrow. I cried, and I think that, you know, it was probably quite good for me to think of his mom, to think of the micro as well as the macro, the huge ripple effect it's had across the globe, but also his mom.
You know, back in June, we had on Alia Hassina, a curator for Black Lives Matter UK, and she told us that the UK has to do a better job of facing its own legacy of racism. Do you sense a shift in the UK?
You know what? Perhaps. I think generally we're learning a lot from America in terms of how to speak, how to protest, how to allow our anger and our righteous rage to be expressed. Generally, British people, I think it's a cultural thing. We don't do that. And I think that means that we're not processing things properly. I think it's a very British thing. So we are learning. We are learning to speak. Yeah, I think it's been a good thing. There are, you know, there's a large percentage of black men who are in prison. I think it's 7 times per person per population, which is terrifying. And yet for some reason, this isn't, not a lot of people know that number. Not a lot of people know, you know, that the last figure I read, I must say, which was about 2 years ago. I don't know if we know that. And why don't we know that? Why don't we know that? I don't know.
Well, it's been 8 months since the UK confirmed its first coronavirus case. And we talked about how you use writing to process trauma. But what do you find yourself turning to for joy right now?
Walking. I go for walks very early in the morning. I wake up around 6 a.m. and I go for a walk between 6:30 and 7. And it's quite nice to do that. I've been doing puzzles, which is quite cool. I think I'm on my fifth puzzle right now. It's a 500-piece puzzle. I've done the edges, and I'm working my way onto cracking the center now. So that's been quite fun.
What's next for you? I know we're waiting the end of I May Destroy You here in the U.S. Is there a second season on the way or new projects that you have in the works right now?
For now, I'm just on a break.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think a lot of us can understand needing to be on a break right now. Well, Michaela Cole, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you. She's the showrunner and star of the HBO series I May Destroy You. Please take good care of yourself.
You too, Jen. Lovely to talk to you.
A reminder, if you like this conversation and you haven't yet subscribed to our podcast, please do. We have guests and stories like this every weekday. This conversation was produced by Catherine Fink and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again soon. This is 1A.